So, Berto, I asked you to watch the Netflix documentary Orgasm Incorporated, the One Taste Story or whatever. I can't remember the full name, but it's a documentary on Netflix about what seemingly is a cult, maybe. So I asked you to watch it. Let's talk about it. What do you say?
I tried to watch it, but I finished too early. But yeah, let's do it.
This is the Psychology in Seattle podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Kirk Honda. I'm a therapist and a professor and someone that understands innuendo. Berto, who are you?
My name is Humberto Castañeda, and I collect candy bar wrappers.
So let me read the official Netflix synopsis of this documentary. It says, sprung from San Francisco's tech bubble and hailed by top health and wellness outlets as a path to fulfillment, One Taste was a sexual wellness company that gained global notoriety through the teaching of a practice called orgasmic meditation. This investigative documentary employs access to 15 years of never-before-seen footage and interviews with former members to pull back the curtain on the organization and its controversial, enigmatic leader. It was produced by Lena Dunham of Girls fame, by the way.
Yeah.
The first, did you catch in the documentary as to why they call this organization One Taste?
Well, she at one point was explaining, the main gal was explaining that it's sort of this bastardized maybe Eastern philosophy where she was saying, hey, look, there is one taste to the universe, essentially. There's one taste to love. There's one. So it's a little bit of a philosophical thing she was going
right.
for.
Right. I mean, remember, so like the Buddha or someone said that there is one taste to the ocean.
Yeah.
When you taste the water, you taste the whole ocean. And she's saying, I think that with one taste of the woman's orgasm, then you taste all of emotion and all of experience or something like that. By the way, trigger warning, because this is going to have discussions of explicit sexual behavior. This is when we really earn our explicit rating on podcast platforms.
Also, and abuse accusations.
Right, and abuse, sexual assault, coercion. We're going to talk about that. Not in detail, but it'll be talked about. Okay. So, One Taste, founded in 2004 by Nicole Dadone and Robert Kendall, but mainly it's Nicole Dadone's brainchild. Just a little bit on her history. She has by the time she founded One Taste, she was probably at her 30s, I'm guessing. I don't know. But it says here that she, on Wikipedia, that she has a bachelor's degree in gender communications from San Francisco State. She studied with teachers of yoga, Kabbalah, and Buddhist meditation. Now, her biography was a bit confusing, and they just briefly, that was the other kind of thing about this documentary. It wasn't a series. It's just a 90-minute short little in and out, if you will.
By the way, I did, full disclosure, I did not enjoy the format of the documentary.
How come?
I actually felt that the information was presented sort of haphazardly, and like you're saying, there was a lot of background that either was not presented or was sort of like glossed over. And then like even when all of a sudden it took a turn, I was like, wait, that they just kind of like said that? Like there's one moment where she says this really shocking thing where she first says like, oh yeah, no, you know, something like, I don't believe in rape or whatever, you know, and then they just kind of move on, and then much later they talk about it. So there were things like that I've seen much better documentaries. But that said, my mouth was open kind of like the whole time. I was like, what?
Yeah. Yeah, it's an entertaining documentary in that way, and that it has a lot of interest. You know, they always do this, right? It starts out with the organization being this nice place for people to come and be able to express themselves or heal or learn things or find connections. And then comes the dark side. You know, it happens. It's the story in terms of the way people are changing. But anyway, her biography as laid out in the documentary, people are saying that the way she talked about her history, that it changed over time. She would seemingly change details willy-nilly. Hard to say. They didn't really demonstrate that very well in the documentary, but people close to her were saying that.
Oh, and sorry, and part of it is that they had footage of her, you know, bits and pieces all over the place. But and maybe it's no, through no fault of their own, but a lot of times when I've seen other documentaries, there's a lot more coming directly from the person, the main subject. Here it was like there were little bits and pieces, and I didn't, like, there's certainly no interview. There was nothing like that. So it was like you, it was leaving to to the viewer to piece it together. And maybe that's the way it is. And that sense that she was never providing a consistent background, maybe that's part of the problem.
Mm-hmm. She did say, quote, I came from great darkness. She was purportedly a stripper, exotic dancer. She was reportedly a high-paid sex worker. She reportedly was sexually assaulted with a knife to her throat. People said she was a monster in just regular romantic relationships before she was the founder of One Taste. She talked a lot about her father. She says, and I just quoted her here, "My dad was a child molester. He had experiences with young girls, and he used me as bait." So she talked about how she felt like she was colluding with her father. And just imagine that if that's true, which there's no reason to disbelieve her.
And he was convicted.
Okay, right. And according to her, yeah. Right, it's all through her story.
That's
so
true.
We don't know. But it would be a weird thing to lie about. And presumably they would have looked it up if it was a big lie. Plus, it might also kind of explain some of her behavior, which we'll get into in a second. But she... Can you imagine that, just being a kid and being used as bait for your father to assault children?
No, the sense I got out of all of it was, oh my gosh, this person must have been incredibly abused, including being used to abuse.
Yeah.
It's unbelievable.
Yeah, and presumably she had a close enough relationship with her dad.
Yeah.
She wanted his attention, loved him the way you love a father.
Yeah.
And she said she felt guilty for colluding. She says the word colluding with his behavior, which you just have to say, oh, Nicole, you were not colluding. You were a child. What else were you supposed to do? And she goes on to say, my dad died in prison on 52 counts of child molestation, end of quote. So when I hear that, given my experience, that means potentially hundreds of victims. Mm-hmm. When you have 52 counts, those are the incidents in which they have enough data, enough evidence to go to court with.
Yeah.
And we all know that most of these incidents of childhood sexual assault lack any kind of evidence that is strongly supported in a court of law. So, or that can be strongly supported. But, and then she goes on to, she seemed to have a very complicated relationship with her dad, just in the little bit that she talked. So not only did she feel like she colluded with him and she felt guilty, but she also was talking about how her dad wasn't a bad person.
Yep.
Which could be true in the sense of
as
behavior,
far as she's,
behavior outside of his sexual assaultive behavior to children. And so, and then she says, he's just bad according to society's. So I was paraphrasing what she was saying, but she was saying that her father is just bad according to society's inability to see the fourth dimension or something like that.
Yeah.
I can't remember exactly what she was saying. She's just like,
all
the simple people think in three dimensions, but if you think in the fourth dimension like I do, then you realize that my dad isn't a bad person at all.
Yeah, they use that a lot. She used that a lot in different bits. It was clear that this was a theme. Like, hey, sure, in our little mundane three dimensions, that person just shot that person, boo, bad. But if you think fourth dimensionally, that's actually an act of love, and we have flowers coming out of the gun or whatever.
Right. And there's so many things I could say about this, but I'll try to keep it brief, which never happens. But let's see if it works. Is that one, if you're raised by a psychopathic person or by someone that's committing psychopathic behavior, meaning lack of empathy, exploitation of others, then you are likely to develop psychopathic behavior or personality in life in which you exploit others and or don't have empathy for others, have a drive to exploit others. Mm. We saw a little bit of this with Teal Swan. Actually, there's a lot of parallels with Teal Swan. Not tremendous amounts, but some. Yeah. Sexually abused younger in life. Attractive young woman who starts a spiritual guru thing in the United States. Yeah. Teal Swan's was more about suicidality and depression and freeing your emotions and finding your true self. Whereas Nicole Daydon's shtick was sexuality and expressing yourself and finding yourself, so to speak, sexually, right. Particularly women. And so it's possible, who knows what her father was like really, and who knows what she's like really, but it's possible that she at the very least learned, oh, this is the way the world works. You exploit others. I mean, not to get into it if you don't want to, Berto, but you were shown when you were five, you were abused by your 12-year-old babysitter. And you were shown, say, you know, of the entire pie chart that represented love and attachment and connection for you, a slice of that pie was informed by this abusive relationship to you. And definitely, when you started to interact with other people, particularly girls your own age, throughout your childhood, teenage life, and adulthood, I don't know about teenage, but definitely childhood and adulthood.
Yep.
This behavior would emerge in you of exploitation.
Right. Yeah, it was definitely dormant, but it came out late. And it was patterned not only as a okay, this person's exploiting me, but also, hey, there's someone else here that's also being exploited, because there was two of us little boys that were babysat by the same person.
Every time?
I mean, we would discuss it. It never happened at the same time. It's just that we would both discuss it, and we would be competing about it, because in our minds it's like, oh, she likes me more, or oh, really, whatever, because that was like, oh, I'm special because I've been included in this little club. And so what messages were being imprinted? Okay, this inappropriate sexuality means closeness and affection. Okay, great. It needs to be furtive, you know, a hidden thing, and we certainly shouldn't talk about it. But it's not just me. Like, this, other people are victimized too, and that's fine. And not only that,
was the furtiveness, did that make it special? Did it seem like, oh, it's so special that it needs to be hidden?
I don't think I felt that way about it, because I actually, like, I remember I wasn't being careful, because of course I'm five. So there's this trip that my dad actually doesn't remember that we took, and it was myself, my dad, this girl's parents, and me. I don't know if the other little boy was there. I don't think so. I think it was just
the girl there?
Yeah, the girl was there.
Okay.
And so we went to this trip, and we were there, and I was like, hey, we should take a shower. And the adults kind of like consider, like, meaning me and the babysitter, and the adults kind of considered it, and then they were like, oh, no. But I was insisting on it, which shows that for me, the secrecy wasn't that big of a deal. I was like, well, isn't this okay? Which is a weird thing, right?
But, well, you're 5'1".
I'm 5, yeah. But part of me also knew that some of what we did was not okay to talk about. So it was okay for me to want to take a shower, but we should probably not talk about everything.
Right.
And also I knew that there was this little secret club that I was in, and I could talk to this other little boy about it and kind of compete about it, but that was about it.
Right. So when you became an adult, when the dormancy ended and you started interacting, maybe while being intoxicated or something, this side of you would occasionally emerge, and you would make other people, women your age, feel the way you felt when you were five. Maybe not to that extent, but
but there was an uncomfortable level, because, and I, of course, I was unaware, because I, in my mind, A, yes, I'm under the influence, and B, I don't know, isn't this what you're supposed to do?
Right. Yeah, because these behaviors get imprinted as an example of how you do things. And whenever we see these abnormal or problematic behaviors, we will really focus on it. But just think about everything that we do as adults.
Yeah.
The most notable thing is speaking whatever native tongue that you speak.
Yeah.
Everything that's coming out of my face right now, through my lungs and my larynx and my facial muscles and my lips, and processed in the brain, preemptively planned ahead of time, the syntax, the accent, the vocabulary, entirely 100% was through absorption.
Yeah. Some things were not absorbed.
Well, my parents are very slow, not great speakers. So I've had to work very hard to become a proper podcaster. But anyway, but that's just language. You think about all the other things, like your preference for different kinds of clothing or the way that you say hello to someone, the way you order food at a restaurant, the way you say hello to a coworker as you're passing them in the hallway. All of that was not invented by us as individuals. It was given to us little by little by everyone around us. That's what you do. And when it comes to sexuality or interacting with people, of course, you know, it's the same thing. And when you're raised well enough, then you have behaviors to merge with others, connect with others, and bid for attention or sexuality from others in a way that is not harmful and not exploitative. But if you're taught that, then that's what you're going to do. Yeah. So you're not a psychopath, but you had exploitative behavior. And if, but if you were a psychopath, then you wouldn't have changed your ways as easily as you did.
Well, and it blows my mind to think, because although I suffered abuse, you know, mine was a contained, like it only happened for a relatively short amount of time. I was able to escape that because I moved to Colombia. And then in Colombia, I never again had abuse. Mm-hmm. And although I wasn't getting treatment for it, I never talked to anyone about it or anything. Yeah.
And you had the opposite as well. You had care
from a lot your of love, attention,
grandparents,
yeah, exactly,
from your dad,
exactly.
That was non-exploitative and loving, and you know, I'm guessing there was sitting on your grandma's lap. There were hugs and kisses that were all appropriate.
That's right. Yeah. And so you take all that stuff, and yet I still ended up having trouble and had to overcome it through therapy and self-introspection and fights with friends and all these things, right?
So you imagine Nicole.
I can't even imagine.
At the very least, potentially 52, if not hundreds of incidents of being a pawn in
for
her...
For years.
Yeah, and so not only was she being exploited by her dad to be a bait, you know, to be the bait for these other children, not only did she... witness the exploitation, at the very least she knew of what was happening, right? That these other kids were being abused by the father. But she also had to, because of the coercion that she was going through, she had to participate in the exploitation itself.
Right.
And that makes you reckon with some morality at a very young age that can cause problems later in life. So who knows, but the allegations that we will get into could be a reflection of this behavior.
Which, of course, never excuses any future behavior.
No.
It's just one of those, like, where does this come from?
Right.
Oh.
Right. Because there are a lot of people who start sexuality-oriented organizations. Alina Gabosch, for example, who passed away a couple years ago, I believe. She was one of the very first guests we had on the podcast 14 years ago.
Yeah.
And she is well known around the world for being a leader in sex positivity and was the founder and director of the Seattle Sex Positive Culture, the Seattle Center of Sex Positive Culture.
Yeah.
Something like that.
SPCC or something.
Yeah.
And I got to tell you, first of all, super impressed when we met her. And at the time, It was a bit of a culture shock for me because even though I like to fashion myself as like a free thinker and all these things, you know, she showed up with her slave and, you know, they had an S&M bond. And then we went to a club and it was like, what is going on? And yet I felt so safe and welcomed and intruded upon. And it was incredible.
Right. As far as we know, Alina Gabosch never exploited or harmed anyone as far as we know. And... So there's nothing wrong with the organization, the One Taste organization.
It seems possible to do it in a way that's not exploitative.
But Nicole, on the other hand, had a different thing, possibly because of her early childhood experiences. Okay, so I just wanted to go over some headlines that were in the documentary. And one, I'm sure you noted as something that would get my goat. The headline in one article was Silicon Valley disrupts orgasm with science.
Oh, I didn't see it. Where was that headline?
It was in the documentary.
Oh my God.
So, okay, first off,
I missed that one.
First off, Silicon Valley. So anything that happens in the San Francisco area is yes. automatically attributed to Silicon yeah. Valley?
It's the computer revolution, man.
But she's she's like this Buddhist American. So
well, and especially because then you add with science, right?
Yeah.
So that
what
sounds
science?
Like...
Science? Like, that's not her thing.
Yeah, dude. She did the research.
I'm sure she talked some about science, but that's like, definitely not the...
If you see that headline, here's what I imagine. It is a tech startup. They have some sort of devices
that are
computerized.
Yeah.
They've used machine learning. Well, maybe not back then. Oh, yeah, actually. Yeah, they've used some machine learning or other techniques.
It's probably robots.
To figure out best optimal this, that, balancing, blah, blah. That's what I'm imagining, yeah. right?
But then the whole world disrupts. You know, it's Everyone a pet disrupts. Peeve of mine. I mean, it's just like, just say revolutionized or... Because, you know, one taste disrupted nothing. Do you know what I mean? There are so many organizations around the world that are along these lines. One taste did nothing. It just was one of thousands of organizations that are trying to promote sex
positivity.
Well, it's
like every bit of news nowadays, what is it, destroys the internet, turns off the internet? I forget what the...
Breaks
the internet.
Yeah.
It breaks the internet.
Another headline that was quoting one of the leaders was, "We are redefining what orgasm is." And I'm just thinking, like, huh? But anyway, so their big thing was orgasmic meditation. So
I will say this, though. And of course, this was on purpose. But like that first part of the documentary, what I thought was very positive is that there is taboo around orgasm, especially female orgasms and female pleasure and anatomy. There's tons of taboos and,
yeah.
oh, you shouldn't talk about it. Women should be this, that. They should be virgins, blah, blah. So I thought, well, yeah, that's super positive. Sounds yeah. like great.
Yeah. And for the record, a lot of the stuff that I was seeing in the documentary, I've been following various yeah. different sex positive organizations for a couple of decades now. And I'm guessing they did a lot of good.
Yeah.
It's a much needed organization. And there's a reason why these things pop up is because our society is so repressed. I mean, like you're saying, Berto, you would like to think of yourself as a free thinker. And on average, you are tremendously more sex positive than the average American. But there's a lot of additional sex positivity ground that you
totally.
could make, you know what I mean? Anyway, let's take a break, get back. Let's talk about orgasmic meditation. What do you say, Bruno?
Let's do it.
Okay, Bruno. So if someone like Nicole Dadon, you were someone like that, and you're a leader, a charismatic leader, cult leader, perhaps, hard mm-hmm. to know. By the way, we'll get into later as to whether or not this was a cult or not. We'll go over my criteria. But if one of those individuals were you, and you were trying to convince the listeners right now who are not patrons to become a patron, what would that sound like?
I want you to close your eyes. I want you to let go of all these attachments that the world places upon you. I want you to realize that your molecules are everyone's molecules. I want you to know that inside of you is a burst of infinite energy that only you can release, but not through the traditional, you know, old hat methods of touching this body part or that. No, by becoming a patron. But if you do it in just the right way and you click that button many times and you get others to click at the same time, and you simultaneously get the world clicking, becoming a patron over and over, then we will be one.
Oh my God. That's got to be top five right there. All right. So orgasmic meditation is a mindfulness practice where you focus your attention and honestly the way that the documentary described it, I was like, huh? I actually had to look up what it was exactly because
Om.
Yeah, you do. Well, they said it was oming, but Did they actually OM?
I don't think they OM'd, but it was like orgasmic meditation, so they abbreviated it to OM.
Oh.
And there's an association with OM and meditation.
Right.
So I don't know if they literally OM.
Yeah, but basically, I think it was centered around women. Men were involved, obviously.
Did you catch, though, that the one guy that was really, pun not intended, deep into the program, said that they also had a male part of the experience, but they didn't advertise that because then they would get flooded with guys wanting to be jacked off, basically.
Oh, okay.
You know?
Well, according to different sources on the internet, so God knows, that it's orgasmic meditation is primarily something for women in which you have a partner, someone that you are in a relationship with or someone you just met, and this partner uses their finger to stimulate the clitoris, and the woman meditates on the sensation. There is supposedly a what they call a connective resonance between the two people that develops over time because the partner, the fingering individual, if you will, is supposed to be totally attuned to the woman. And Nicole Dadon described her work as one that places a near exclusive emphasis on women's pleasure, in which love, romance, and even flirtation are not required. So, in other words, we want to get right to the sexual experience of stimulation and orgasm, and we don't need to be in love. We don't need romance. We don't need flirtation. She seemed really, I think she saw, the way that it seemed to me was that she was promoting the idea that if you fully experience the orgasm experience while also focusing on you as a human being, on your body, your breathing, your attention, taking the time to enjoy something, pushing out things that might intrude on your mind, like, oh no, I have to do taxes next week, or oh no, that thing I said yesterday was stupid.
Right.
You know, they didn't really go into this that much, but it seemed in line with a lot of other meditation, mindfulness practices. But it involved not only orgasm and not only someone fingering you to orgasm, but also someone fingering you to orgasm while you're in front of a crowd of people.
Right.
Maybe with other meditators next
also
to you.
Also oming.
Yeah. So is that the way it seemed to you?
Yeah, that's the way it seemed to me. And granted, okay, some of the public exhibitionism part could maybe get a little funky to many folk. But still, to that level, I thought, hey, man, there's a lot of positive here. Also, at several times I said, oh, you know, these are a lot of young, attractive people. But actually, when you saw a lot of the people involved, I'm not saying they weren't attractive. I'm just saying they looked normal. And there did seem to be a lack of emphasis on money or position or power or looks. It's just like, hey, come here and explore and have orgasms and be a human that's loving each other. That all seems super positive to me. Super great, actually.
Yeah.
Like, wow, okay, we can be like a little bit more of a tribe.
Yeah.
And you
if
know,
everything was consensual,
yeah,
and it didn't have any allegations of exploitation of the workers and the participants, then this would just be, like I said, just another one of the thousands of sex positive movements around the world.
Yeah.
And it would have this unique, or not unique, this maybe at one end of the bell curve element in which you have these particular demonstrations where people volunteer to be fingered to orgasm. I don't know what sort of verb I'm supposed to stimulated to orgasm in the bright lights in front of a crowd of people. And you could imagine that would be part of the experience, right? Not just having an orgasm,
right,
but also being fully literally naked, spreading your legs in front of a crowd of people and having that very intimate, vulnerable experience while everyone is paying attention to you and caring about you and not judging you and encouraging you. mentally, but then afterwards saying, what a great thing, you're a great person, that was wonderful.
Absolutely. Look, during the first 15 minutes of the documentary, I had already bought my tickets for San Francisco. I had booked a hotel, but then I watched the rest of the documentary.
Right. So why would people attend something like this, the demonstrations? What do you think the different motivations were?
Well, okay, so definitely you have to divide it up. If we were talking about guys, I do think, and some of this was alluded to, there are many guys who would just be like, wait, sex? And I can go have sex and do crazy things? Sure, sign me up, right? There were some that seemed to be there because they actually were naturally open in their sexuality and they wanted to kind of continue that vein. On the female side, it seemed to me like a lot of it was a combination of either some repression or some issues that they had to work through. Maybe some of them had some abuse. And then others seem more just, you know, Bay Area open-minded. that's who they showed, you know. What also was alluded to, and that's what I was mentioning, that one guy, he's one of the first guys they interviewed.
Yeah.
He seems like one of the OG members. He was saying, hey, look, you know, if we advertise that there's also an aspect of this that's for male pleasure, then we would just get like tons of randos, just, you know.
Yeah, they talked about how to manage the ratio.
Yeah.
And by the way, this was heavily centered on heterosexual relationships.
That's true.
Seemingly. Yeah. In order to keep the ratio half and half-ish, they charged the men, but not the women.
Oh, right. Yes. That's true.
So women, even participants, people who were just witnessing the sexual demonstrations, apparently didn't have to pay at all, but the men did.
I got the sense that that was for some level of it, but like for courses and things.
Oh, maybe not.
But definitely, you're right, that they made a point of saying that. Because you're right. If they need, they even said at another part in the interview, one of the gals that was one of the main members said, "Hey, in order to be able to balance out the ratio, a lot of us had to be involved with a lot of the guys that would show up."
Right. The workers, which we'll
the
get
workers,
into, in a bit. Yeah. So other things that One Taste did, they did a lot of different events and exercises. It wasn't just around this demonstration thing. There was a lot of sex ed. There's a lot of Nicole giving kind of guru lectures, if you will. She just speaks really off the cuff. She doesn't seem to have, you know, unlike I think Teal Swan or Elizabeth Holmes or someone, I feel like Nicole came across as very spontaneous and genuine and a little rough around the edges even. And by the way, Nicole herself would do demonstrations.
Yeah.
She would be naked as people would stimulate her. And so she, you know, she participated in the
right.
whole thing. There were other kinds of events like, I would call them like humanistic experience events where people might stand in a room and scream, or people would walk around a room looking at people with eye contact. It's a real common set of exercises that are within the, I don't know what to call it. This, some people might call it the self-help event industry or the woo-woo industry or the humanistic experiential industry. I don't know.
You're right that if I'm comparing this to different, you know, people we've looked at, some of them, there's that range of some of them are always on. Like no matter when they're talking, who's talking to them, when they're always on, like an Elizabeth Holmes, right? Others, like who was the Fire Festival guy?
Yeah.
He's Billy a little sloppier. Like sometimes he's on, sometimes he's not on, sometimes he's, you know. And then this gal struck me as she could pass off as quite normal until she's talking about something and says something so outrageous.
Right. And by the way, like rape is normal.
Yeah.
And it's all in your head.
Yeah.
That was her big thing was that, hey, you think of yourself, all you women out there who think of yourself as victims of rape and sexual assault. I am a victim of sexual assault and I freed myself because I just look at it differently. And whenever I try to, so it's just so interesting because there's so much about this that is just classic adult syndrome of childhood sexual abuse.
Yeah.
So one of the things that you will develop, we've already talked about it, is a skewed sense of morality and what's fair to exploit others, right?
Yeah.
But also, for a lot of people, as they're recovering from sexual exploitation when they were children, as adults or teenagers, they will often bifurcate, and sometimes the same person will vacillate between two positions. They'll either become extremely abstinent and really want to shut down sexuality completely,
right,
in their lives. They might dress very baggy clothing. They might completely avoid dating. They might, I don't know, just various different things that they might do. And then on the other side, you have hypersexuality, or they might dive into sexuality in a way that doesn't really lead to healing for them. It's just either sexuality for sexuality's sake, or could lead to exploitation and reharm of themselves.
Yeah.
And so people will, without any guidance or treatment or recovery, mentorship, they're kind of left to those two modes. It's really hard for these individuals to have a balance in their life.
You know, it's interesting you say that, because when I was a teenager, I didn't, like I said, I was almost not aware of what had happened, even though I did in the back of my mind know it. And I definitely didn't have any feelings like that, or, you know, consciously in my mind. And also, I was very Christian and very like, oh, I'm not going to have, you know, anything till I'm married, all these kinds of things, right? Then much later, I do remember in my late 20s especially, and again, especially related to alcohol, although not always, I would do self-harm things, like, you know, do something with a stripper or something without any protection or something. You know, like stuff that is really dumb and was me trying to recreate the abuse situation without knowing. Like, again, just like me, like, do-do-do-do-do, and then later thinking about it, going, wait a minute. That's odd.
Right. Is that really what I wanted to
do?
Yeah. And one of the outgrowths of that side of things for many, not all, but some, is they will find a sense of power as they go into sexuality, right? That they're like, well, I'm always being harmed by sex. I'm never really enjoying it. I don't even really know what it means to enjoy sex. I don't even know what it means to ask myself, what do I want? But I know you're supposed to do sex, and I'm going to be abused and exploited at some point. That's just going to happen. But at least I can gain control over the situation. I will be the one who dictates I am assaulted, when I am harmed.
Okay, that's totally what my experience was, because when I had these experiences, and it literally was always with a stripper, you know. It wasn't the same person. It was like different people throughout a set of years. And not all the time, but it would happen from time to time. It was never about my pleasure, ever. It was always about me pleasuring them. And, which is exactly what I was doing at 5 years old, because it was not at all about my pleasure. And I wasn't actually enjoying it. Like, if I think back, I'm like, there wasn't anything hot and awesome about it. It was just me literally like, oh, I must pleasure this person. And also putting myself in harm's way, you know, STDs, things like that. But none of it clicked. All of it was like, this is what I'm doing.
Yeah, I think it generates from both what I'm saying, potentially, you know, case by case basis of, well, at least I'll be the one in control.
I'm the one in control because I set up the situation. I asked them if they want. No one was doing it without their consent. Nothing.
You know. I'm going to be harmed.
Yeah.
It's going to happen. I might as well be the one who says when and where.
Yeah.
The other part of it is that skewing of the bell curve of morality and what's the way things are supposed to be, and that pie chart of what it means to connect with others. It's possible that when you would do this, you would feel disconnected from people or from romantic partners, from companionship. And alcohol gave you this excuse to find the fastest way from A to B, which was part of this pie chart, which is, well, I will put myself in a situation where I'm exploited.
Right.
And that felt connected. connecting when I was a kid, and it does have elements of connection, I guess.
Yeah.
But I don't, and there's never a point where, is this really what I want? Because you weren't allowed to ask yourself that question.
No, right.
And, you know, this is compounded by the fact that your mom abandoned you, and
yeah,
you didn't have a lot of attunement around those early years. Right. So that question of what do I want? How do I matter? Might not have been fully resonant with you. So you're just kind of randomly shooting in the dark, trying to find ways of meeting your needs and only kind of meeting your needs some of the time.
And by the way, and it's being reinforced by a society and cultural norms, right, that make it feel like it's actually okay. And what's the big deal?
I mean, well, and you scored.
Right.
I mean, wait, you got a stripper to da-da-da? Like,
yeah,
you're the man.
Right.
Right. So it's possible that for Nicole, she decided that part of her way of dealing with it was to do that side of things, which is to become very sexual. I don't know. This is purely speculative, but I've certainly worked with a lot. Any therapist out there who've worked with any clients, really, because you'll come, so many people have the adult syndrome of sexual abuse as a child, because so many people were sexually exploited as children. But so it's possible that Nicole was doing that, and as a way of feeling like she's in control of things, because she was massively exploited when she was a kid, she's like, I'm going to be the one to exploit, and I'm going to be the one, you know, I'm going to be laid bare and exposed in ways that I don't really want to anyway. I might as well be the one in control of that.
Dude.
And if I'm the leader of this cult thing, then I will be able to dictate that.
And bring others to do the same to them.
Right. So I will get employees. I will exploit my underlings, my women employees, and you know, we haven't gone into this, and maybe we won't fully, but in the documentary, there are a few women employees who talk about how they got sucked in by the model and, you know, all the things that we're talking about that are very attractive. There's a huge need for this in our society, because our society is so backwards that when people come across stuff like this, they're just like, oh my God, this is like an oasis in the desert. And then the exploitation starts to happen. Nicole seemingly, allegedly starts to coerce her underlings in the same way that she was coerced by her father to suck other people in to exploit them, so that everyone's being exploited.
Right.
Nicole is exploiting the underlings. The underlings are exploiting the Johns, if you will.
Yeah.
Or the other women below those managers to make sure that to force them emotionally, coerce them to have sex with other men. And that's why eventually the FBI starts looking into this, because it on the surface, it looks like a woo-woo, self-helpy, humanistic organization about sex positivity. But when you look at the structure of it begins to look like sex trafficking.
Yeah.
That right within our own borders, American citizens being coerced to have sex with people for money, because you have men coming in paying high fees, sometimes thousands of dollars for, you know, particular high-end events. And Nicole is telling the women, you know, because the women would be like, I don't know if I want to do this. And Nicole would say, well, that's you listening to the bad side of society, or that's your dad telling you that you can't be sexual. You need to free yourself. She was very good at reframing things. And you could see how in some situations that would be really helpful, right? Like someone comes in and says, I don't know, I just feel like my body is a piece of crap. I just feel like I'm ugly and I'm gross and my vagina is disgusting and I smell gross or something. And then Nicole helps this woman embrace her smell and her body and her vagina and love herself. It's a reframe. It's just a matter of the way you're looking at it.
Yeah.
Or maybe even more specifically, I'm disgusting because I have a kink where I want people to pee on my legs or something. And Nicole would come in and say, no, that's not disgusting. That's beautiful. It's wonderful. Society tells you it's wrong. So let's all pee on each other's legs. Let's do this right now. And then, you know, the woman or whoever has this cathartic, wonderful moment. Everyone's peeing on it. Everyone's like, it would be transformational for these people. And so you can imagine that you would go from that to, because of her. So the other part of her syndrome as an adult, again, is that bell curve of morality, the range of what is considered okay to do to other human beings is skewed to one side of bad things. That there's a part of her, and especially because she's a kid having to wrestle with this notion, that rape and exploitation sexually of people who are not in control, that's okay. It's only kind of bad, or maybe it's not bad at all. And and you know, the dad was in her ear going like,
absolutely,
no, the girls want this, you know, this is okay. This is normal. I'm helping these girls.
The justification was obvious. And she even said at one point, just like you said, well, you know, you could decide that you're a victim, but you don't have to. And then she also said, and also same thing goes for like, okay, I guess you're a victimizer for the rest of your life.
Right.
Right. She was trying to point to this thing of like, even victimizers are maybe not victimizers.
Right. So if we translate that to when she's 7, we could absolutely imagine why she would develop this way of thinking. Because she probably even was friends with some of these victims post-victimization. Yeah. And the girls, her friends, were probably like, I don't think I like what your dad did. And what is the 7-year-old Nicole supposed to do?
Right.
I mean, that's an impossible situation. You could absolutely see a 7-year-old going like, well, it's just because you look at it the wrong way. Like, my dad's a nice person and rape isn't a thing and you're just choosing to be a victim.
Yeah.
Everything's fine. Everything's fine. Everything's fine. Everything's fine. Everything's fine. Everything's fine. Everything's fine.
Dude, so monstrous.
And then without any enough treatment, maybe, or any treatment or anything.
Right.
Then as an adult, you somehow find yourself at the head of a large sexual organization. Well, it's possible that that's going to start to show itself, that idea that, well, rape's just a matter of perspective.
Well, and look, we don't know, but it's quite possible that the way this whole thing started was actually quite pure in her intentions and what she was thinking she was going to do. Mm-hmm. It's not necessary that she was like Machiavelli, like, if I set up this thing, I could then eventually abuse people.
Right.
It's possible that it was, but probably more likely that she was just like, no, I mean, I'm just literally trying to be sex positive. And then she gets more power, and then it's easier to actually.
Well, that and someone suggested, or their analysis, and it, you know, it's hard to know because there's just one person. But what they were saying was, behind the scenes, Nicole was saying things like, I can do whatever I want to people.
And I
can make them do anything.
Yeah.
And I'm the lion and everyone else is the gazelle. And according to this individual, as she gained more power, and because you imagine the first time she did a demonstration sexually with like a member of the audience, how visceral that would be for Nicole to be like, oh my God, like whether she believed it to be helpful or not. That's a massive amount of power that you have to successfully, and to have all the audience members go like, oh my God, that was the most important experience of my entire life. You can imagine for her, for Nicole, she's like, whoa. And then if you are obsessed with power, as many psychopaths are, I don't know if she's a psychopath, but if she is, you can imagine like, well, that gets mundane. Now you gotta up the ante. You know?
Like when she's telling two of her workers, like, hey, you two are having a disagreement. I don't want you to come back until you've had sex.
Right.
And they didn't want to.
Right.
He said like it was awkward, but they felt compelled to do it and they couldn't return till they had.
And the key here is that not only Nicole would do this, but the upper management adopted Nicole's ways and would thus perpetrate these abuses on
which
other
seems
people.
So common in these
cults.
Yeah, we've seen that. And, wow.
Yeah. So when we get back, let's answer the question, is One Taste a cult? What do you say, Berto?
Let's do it.
All right, back from the break. Before moving on, before I forget, I just want to say, because I know many of you listening right now are at some point in your healing journey regarding your own sexual exploitation in your history. And I don't want to paint a picture like everyone is the same, and because everyone is. There's a lot of different obviously there's a lot of different personalities involved, a lot of different experiences, a lot of different syndromes. Some people have PTSD, some people don't. Some people have personality disorder, some people don't. Some people have depression or anxiety, some people don't. Some people have extroverted personality, some people, you know, there's a lot of variety across the board. So I just want to say that. And I want to say that wherever you are on your journey, there is a path to healing. The outcome and the goal that you're often trying to achieve, and it's up to you to define your goals, but often with the clients that I'm working with, they want a life in which they have what they would call a healthy sexual life, a life that involves them having sex that is self-gratifying and also bonding with other people, a way of having sex that doesn't involve stress. You know, I'll talk with people who they might be 45 years old, and I'll ask them as a part of my assessment on a scale from 1 to 10, with 10 being extremely stressed out and distressed, anxious, you know, upset, and 1 being like super calm, where are you often, or what's the range when you're having sex? Where are you on that scale? And through the interview and the various different ways of asking that question, a lot of people will tell me their baseline, they've never been below a 5.
Mm.
Entire life, 45 years old, every time they've had sex, they've always been a 5 out of 10.
Wow.
On the distress scale because of their traumatic history, right? Either PTSD is being triggered, or they just have a lot of schemas that involve shame or something. Or they've never even asked themselves, do I want to have sex? Do I even want to be with this person romantically? I don't even know if I can ask that question.
Fall on autopilot.
Yeah. So it can be rough, obviously. And so the goal is so that every time you have sex, you're a 1 or a 2.
Yeah.
And so if you're out there, that's one goal. Another goal is that you know what you want and you can embody what you want. Another goal is if you do have trauma symptoms, trauma reactivity, that you can recover from that and thus not be triggered anymore. It might seem impossible, but it's one of the things that therapy helps really well with, which is that recovery from trauma, that sort of thing. And potentially spiritual elements to sexuality, connection with a higher being or God or the universe. Some people want that, some people don't. Mindfulness, being in the moment, enjoying yourself, really connecting with other people. You know, those are things that are available to people as they recover more and more, is my point. So I want to give people hope is my point. And there are many therapists that specialize in this kind of work. Okay, so is this a cult, Berto? I actually had a chance to revise my criteria. I keep revising it, but I like this current distillation of the different criteria. So I have 7 criteria.
Okay.
Let's go through them one by one. Number one, Berto, charismatic authoritarian leader. Is there a charismatic authoritarian leader?
It does seem that way, yes.
How
they
so?
They all speak very highly about her. She stands in front of them all and gives them very opinionated direction, instruction, and commands. And it seems like it's her way or the highway. But what we didn't see when we saw the Teal Swan one, there were clearly moments that were filmed where it's literally, it's my way or the highway.
Right.
This one, they were all implied or someone related them, but you could kind of see it through the seams. It just wasn't as evident in the film.
Right. Yeah. Definitely charismatic. I mean, if I didn't know she was allegedly a cult leader who harmed others, I would be drawn to her as a lecturer. She has a very intelligent, inspirational way of speaking.
Yeah, every time, even when she's saying the kooky things of fourth dimension stuff, except when she starts actually saying vile, horrible things, it does. It sounds like, wow, this is compelling.
Yeah. Yeah, the authoritarian part of that criterion, I think is, for in my opinion, in terms of the documentary and what they demonstrated, it didn't seem like as much as the others, like Keith Raniere in particular. I mean, he literally imprisoned women for his own sexual gratification. literally had sex slaves who he would coerce. He would make them commit crimes and then film that and then use those.
Yeah, to blackmail.
Use that evidence to blackmail them so that he could imprison them and make them do whatever he wanted to them. So that's authoritarian. What Nicole Dadon was doing was in that direction. You know, like someone was saying that someone wanted to leave the group and she was very pointed in her disdain and disapproval of this individual, that kind of thing. Okay, number two. So with number one, we'll go like, well, we'll give a half
point. At least half point, yeah. And there weren't any accounts, at least I don't remember, of, and they ruined my life because I left.
Yeah.
Now, that again, that doesn't mean there wasn't coercion. That doesn't mean, it's just, well, the extent of it is...
Yeah. Number two, isolation of the followers. Isolation. Did Nicole and the second-in-command woman, did they isolate the followers from others?
That I don't know. Like, they obviously had their club, and they a lot of them lived together, which is isolating. But it seemed, I don't know. I didn't get the sense of like, and I wasn't allowed to see my family, and I couldn't leave the compound.
Exactly. Yeah. So there didn't seem to be any evidence of that. Number three, systems of control. Were there systems within the dogma or the practices of the organization that worked to control the members?
I do believe so. Again, maybe not as aggressive as we've seen other examples, but there were things like the things about, hey, if you're feeling a certain way, you're actually, the not only her, but her cohort would apply pressure, group pressure to, okay, well, then you're going to go and get ohmed right now, or you're going to have sex with this person. And there were other things like there was a lot of implications about the expectations of how you're supposed to talk about things and what you're supposed to say and not say. And so, yes, but again, we've seen worst examples.
Right. So maybe another half point. Yeah. One guy said, so as I described this, Berto, tell me why they would do this.
Okay.
Why so often cults will do this technique. So this guy was... So Nicole asked this guy a question in this group exercise. Nicole says, like, what do you want out of sexuality or something? And actually, a woman also described a very similar thing where his first answer was honest. And he's like, well, this is the way I want, or this is what I see or something. And Nicole didn't like the answer because, well, we don't know what the because was, but clearly Nicole didn't like the answer, so she turns away from him. Then he's like, well, you know, he's describing this. He's like, I really wanted her attention because I loved her. I thought she was awesome and brilliant and a genius. And so when I gave an answer that was honest but didn't really cause her to pay attention to me, I blurted something else out that was more intense along the lines of what I think she was actually looking for. And then she turned to me and she was intently paying attention to me. And then she moved in on my soul in that moment. And another woman kind of said a similar thing. Why would a cult leader do that?
Yeah, I totally remember now too, because there's also the thing about where it was like, what's the most important thing to you? This. What's more important than that?
I want a baby, she says.
Yeah, and like she gets her all the way to something that she didn't really mean, but she pushed her to an answer she wanted her to give, you know?
Right.
And then there was another example.
Meaning that the woman goes deep and she's like, well, I've always wanted a baby. And in her mind, she's like, wow, Nicole really worked on me because I didn't initially disclose that. But when I really think about it, I want a baby. So, and then Nicole was like, no, go deeper. And the woman's like, deeper? And she's like, yeah. And Nicole's like, yeah, you're resisting. You got to go deeper. And the woman's like, I don't know if, what do you mean? I feel like that was pretty deep.
Yeah.
But to Nicole, it wasn't what she was looking for.
Right.
But that's the key. What do you think, why is Nicole looking for something other than what people are actually giving her?
Yeah, my sense is this. Like, look, if I'm selling you on not just, hey, look, buy my book or rent it out of the library and you'll get some good tips for life. But no, come join my program, pay me money, become one of my acolytes. then I need to have something that I'm offering to you that seems really unique, differentiated. You can't just go buy it at the bookstore. And so how do I do that? Well, one way is that as you're looking around the room, everyone seems to, A, give the same answer that matches what this person is saying, or B, the person seems to be the only one that can pull out the right information from everyone, right? And so you start getting the sense of like, oh, okay, well, since I'm seeing everyone sort of agree with this person's points, then they must be onto something. And B, it seems like no one's got the answers in this room except this person.
Yeah.
That's worth it.
Yeah, that's one method of control. It puts you as a charismatic leader in this unique position of you have the ability. Because if you're watching something like that, you're like, whoa, they are resisting. Oh, after 15 minutes, Nicole finally broke her down and she admitted this other thing. Mm-hmm. And similar to hypnosis shows, which are largely faked by the participants as well. To explain that, an entertaining hypnosis person will ask for volunteers and there's a chance that he doesn't know any of these people. But you bring them up on stage and then you do this song and dance where you're hypnotizing them. And then you say, okay, I want you to have an orgasm here on stage. The individual is not out of control of their behavior. The hypnotized individual can refrain. Now, you could argue that the hypnotism process allows them to free their mind or something like this. But, you know, science has looked at this up. Imagine if we could hypnotize people to do things that they didn't remember and that would be completely against their nature. There's been a bunch of studies on this. Like, one of the findings is that people that volunteer to go on stage to be hypnotized are typically your more outgoing stage-oriented people.
Right.
They want to show off. The other thing that happens, and it's analogous to this one situation I was in where I was called up on stage by a magician, and it was basically the same situation. The magician did a card trick, and I can't remember how it worked, but he needed me to guess a certain number.
Yeah.
And written in a small little thing on the inside of his hand, as he's doing this gesture to me on the stage, I can see on his hand like the number 2. And so in that moment, I was like, oh, he wants me to say 2 because he has the 2, right. He has the 2 of hearts in his pocket,
right,
or something like that. And I'm on stage and everyone is, this is like midway through this show, so everyone's enthralled by this magician.
So are you going to ruin the show for everyone?
Am I a total asshole? Because that's a dick move right there, right?
Right.
And then what? And then let's say, okay, so, and I have a half of a second, less than half of a second to think about it. It's so much easier just to say 2.
Yeah.
Even though I know I'm lying, but it's a magic show. Everyone understands there's right. trickery. It's not actual supernatural things that are happening. But anyway, but there's so many things about that I am actively lying to everyone. I walk off the stage. I don't walk off and go, by the way, he has 2 written. I don't say anything. When we're walking out of the theater after the show, I don't turn to people and go, he had a 2, and I don't say a thing.
You're just maintaining the illusion.
Because I'm not a dick. Because the social situation, no one wants that. The audience members, they don't want to see a show that is that simple, right? And so for me to tell the truth means I have to ruin everyone's night. I have to ruin, you know, whoever I went with, my friends, the fellow crowd, the magician, the venue. I would, by me continuing to lie. Okay, but that's just a magic show. You elevate that to a hypnosis situation, you have a very similar phenomenon.
Sure.
You elevate that to a cult situation, now you have a problem.
Yeah. No, I mean, like, I've even experienced that in a minor way. You know, think about sometimes when you go to a movie and you walk out with people you went to. If it's like you and me, I'll tell you what I feel, right? But a lot of times...
But if you're with, like, strangers that you don't know that well and you hated it and they loved it, you're not going to be like, that was the you have terrible taste in movies.
Perfect example. When I went to see Encanto, first of all, I had my daughters and our friends' daughters. And we all walk out of the theater and the girls are going crazy. Oh my God, that was so good. What am I supposed to do? Really? You guys have no taste in movies. I'll start pointing out all the flaws. I mean, you know, it's like.
And you probably said, yeah, it was great.
It's great.
Yeah.
It's great.
You lied.
Yeah.
Because you didn't want to ruin everyone's time. Well, that's what a cult does.
Another example is even more self-induced, basically hypnotism. When I saw episode one for the first time in the theater, actually probably the first two times in the theater. Star Wars episode one, where I see it. And it's not that I walked out and I said to myself, ooh, I didn't like it, but I'm going to lie to my friends because I don't want to disappoint them. No, no, no. I came out of the theater going, I love that movie.
Well, the way of comparing it to these other situations is you have two parts of yourself.
Mm-hmm.
You have one part that hates the movie.
That are all these things that I'm quieting. I'm like, don't worry about that.
Internally needs to love it because of how much you've invested and how much you've convinced yourself it's going to be great, how much you loved the original trilogy. And so the part of you that it wants to tell the truth that it sucks is cowed, is afraid, is being subdued and controlled by the part of you that needs it to be a good movie. So another aspect of control that this kind of thing produces is gaslighting, right? So I'm sitting there and I really want Nicole to like me, and Nicole is asking me a question like, you know, what's at the foundation of your sexuality? And I dig a little deep and I say something. And she's like, no, go deeper.
Right.
And I'm like, oh, okay, fine. Okay, well, I'll go deeper. And then I say something more vulnerable, more something that I maybe can admit to myself. And I say that and I'm like, oh. And at that moment, it's true that Nicole is helping me and validating me. So I feel accepted and loved. And there's been tons of love bombing up until this point.
Right.
And I'm like, oh, wow, this is working. And then she says, no. That's not deep. Go deeper.
Yeah.
And I'm like, well, she's probably right because she's always right, but I don't think she's right because only I would. And that was pretty deep for me. And then I might say something like, well, I don't know if I think that was the deep thing. I think that was deep. And she's like, no, that's not deep. So what's happening now is now I have to reckon with two options. I can either continue to assert truth for me,
right,
which is that is the deepest thing for me in my sexuality, or I have to go along with the lie. I have to accept that I don't know how to evaluate my own mind.
Look, and you're gonna lose because what happens is everyone else in the room, or at least 80% of them, when you're trying to hold that line, they're going to smile and look at each other knowingly. Right. Oh, we've all been there.
They all want Nicole to win because they're all on the Nicole train.
And so their conclusion, whether they really believe it or not, is, oh, he's not quite there yet. He's almost there.
Right.
You can get there.
They're not thinking Nicole's wrong.
Right.
They're thinking that guy is wrong.
And this is the key, which is basically what we were alluding to earlier. Part of the reason you can't land on that answer that was true to you is because that's not the program we're selling. We're not selling a program where it's just a whole bunch of disparate truths that everyone kind of arrives to. No, no, no. Because what was the truth she finally arrived to? The reason for sex is because I need to own, right? That was her final truth. But that's the program. So how coincidental that reinforces the core message of the program.
Right. And then, so she probably knew that Nicole would sign off on that and go, exactly.
Exactly, yeah.
And so then in that moment, you also have to, you have a choice. And if you want things to go well for you in this group and you've signed off on this model or this organization as a lifesaver, then you have to convince yourself that you are not the arbiter of your own mind. Nicole is. I don't know
That's
who
right.
I am. I don't know how to answer questions. I don't know what's really deep. I don't know who I am. Nicole knows who I am. And when you hand that over, that's gaslighting.
Dude, you know what? As I'm thinking about this, this is it reminds me of my landmark, my brief landmark experience, because it had that similar thing where I'm sitting there and I'm realizing I have two choices. I could play along and I see what where they're heading with this, and I could just participate the way they want me to and answer the way that I think they need me to answer things, and I will be a transformed individual at the end, and they will have proven their system works.
The leaders will accept me.
Exactly.
My fellow classmates.
Everyone will be like, bravo, we did it together. I could do that.
Or I can go against everyone in this room.
For 3 days, right?
Yeah.
Or a third option, I could leave, right? And I decided to leave after the first day. And
but if you were hooked on the model being a lifesaver, like if they had, if you were open or needy of something and you needed to believe that this was going to help you because you were desperate, then you could imagine making a different choice.
Especially because I realized that the second option, where I'm going to hold the line, that actually wasn't a real option. They didn't allow you to hold the line. Hence why, when I look back at it, I'm thinking, hey, I left after the first day. I'm not sure how much it's I left after the first day versus they did everything they could to make sure no one like me remained after the first day.
Yeah.
Because they need yay-sayers for those last bits.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, so we'll give a half point. Because system of control, third criterion, certainly some, but not nearly as much as other cults that we see. Number four, indoctrination. So this involves recruitment, love bombing, the reframing stuff that she would talk about, us versus them. Didn't seem like a lot of that.
There are three things I noticed. You mentioned love bombing. They specifically mentioned love bombing. That was clearly evident. The second one was actually the breaking down, which is similar to, speaking of landmark.
And Teal Swan. And Teal Swan.
Yeah, exactly. Do you remember that scene where it was like she was giving her truth to this one dude and like just like saying all these things that are terrible about them? It's like, and you're this, and you're that, and you're terrible, and you're terrible. That's breaking them down. And, you know, they frame it as like, well, we got to get to the, we got to chop it all down to build you back up.
Right. So on one hand, this is a sound, gestalt-y, experiential, humanistic method that has been a part of the psychotherapeutic world for decades, in which you, it's, you know, like, I won't do this to you, Berto, but if I were, it would be something like, I would try to find you where you're proud of yourself. And I would say something like, your job is actually useless. You are wasting your time.
What's wrong with collecting, like what's wrong with collecting candy wrappers?
Or you being a podcast host is just you being narcissistic. And you're like, well, yeah. And then I would really go for it, though. I'd really just
that means
like,
you're adding zero value to the world.
You're a piece of shit. You're just taking up space. Yeah. So on one hand...
Do you really mean... Is this how you're breaking the news?
I mean, it's just pointed back at me tenfold. But the idea, potentially, if it's consensual and it has a sound reason to do so and you're not trying to coerce someone into your therapy program, help someone to look beyond the shell, the facade that they've built up, right? This was a big part of Fritz Perl's thing was like, don't be a phony. You're a phony. You're trying to act like a high-class white American, but we all know that deep down, there's more there. You're a rich, specific, unique individual. You don't have to, because, you know, Gestalt came out of the 50s, 60s when there was a lot of conformity going on, you know? And so you could see how, for some people, that would be really helpful. It would free them of the shackles of the imposition of the facade that they've adopted, seemingly voluntarily, but probably not. On the other hand, it can absolutely, like you're entering the military and you need people to not think for themselves. You need them to think as a part of a unit. You can't have individual free thinkers. You have to follow orders. Yeah. And so we have to break your ego down so that you fully believe at the foundation that you're nothing.
Yeah.
And then that gives me the ability to define who and what you are, which means that I can extract all your money. I can make you do whatever I want so that I can get more money and power and my needs can be gratified by you. And you could see how a cult would do that.
I, I also think that that breakdown process, what's interesting is you could think, okay, well, maybe that's really useful, especially for people already in power. Like, what if people that have, the more power you have, the more you, as part of your ongoing self-therapy or whatever, you get to listen to what others find as flaws with your approach. Not necessarily insults and things like that, but rather, so imagine in her case, she has a round table where it's like, okay, tell me what you don't think is working here. Tell me what you see I'm doing wrong, right? Like a feedback session, because she's the one in power. And guess what? People in power tend to get bigger and bigger heads and tend to, you know, let it go to their head. So that might be actually useful. Again, not insulting her, but just really like giving these pointed piece of feedback. But when it's her, the powerful one, insulting the newbies, the noobs, that is the part that's shady. That's the control bit.
Yeah. I mean, who knows, but it certainly would fall in line with cult-like behavior. Number five, there's no legitimate reason to leave is a universal cult criterion. Yeah, it didn't seem like this one was met very strong.
If so, they didn't present it.
Yeah, I mean, maybe a little bit, because those people who were wanting to leave would be coerced into staying, but it wasn't necessarily demonstrated in a quintessential way like we would see with other cults. You know, in other cults, they'll say like, well, I don't want to live in the compound anymore. I feel like I want to do something else with my life. They would say, you are the devil now.
Yeah.
And if you, just you having that thought means we have to do 6 weeks of exorcism and tie you to a bedpost. So obviously that's
not see that. And maybe it's the cult wasn't allowed to run its course, but
yeah. Which could be an indication of our system working. Number six, and this is the one I added, which I think is important to be explicit about, is that the organization causes unreasonable harm to themselves or others.
That one, there are accounts in the documentary that seem to have caused unreasonable harm to others.
Right.
Yeah. Members of the organization.
Right. Because if all the control or the, not control, but the tactics or the techniques or the exercises, the demonstrations, for example, were done without anyone being unreasonably harmed.
Yeah.
Meaning that, you know, because you could see a situation where a legit, well-run, healthy organization would even do the same demonstrations, and they would have volunteers, and they say, like, okay, I want you to go home, and I want you to think about it. Talk with your therapist, make sure that this is okay with you, given your traumas, whatever. And then once that works out, then you can come back and make an informed, and here's a consent form that has all the possible things that could happen to you. There'll be a little meeting beforehand of just like, so are you sure you want to do this? Because,
and here's your safe word.
Yeah, and it could go this wrong,
right?
Or understand that all the people in that room, they know who you are, and they could tweet that they saw you. There's nothing illegal about. They're not supposed to, and they probably won't. But is that okay with you? You understand? A lot of emotions could happen in the moment, and then the person's like, "Yeah, you know, something kind of wonky could happen to me, but I so much want to do this. I've wanted to do it for a second." Okay, so they come up on stage, they do it, and they have some corner of their trauma is triggered, and they have 6 weeks of depression, anxiety, and dissociation, and so you could see a situation like that, someone would be harmed, but you took a lot of precautions to avoid it. So it's not that an organization, whether or not it causes harm or not, it's if it's unreasonable and if the potential good or the demonstrated good doesn't outweigh the justification of taking the risk for harm. Because, and you could even say that in the scenario I laid out, that even given what we saw from the documentary, that the potential transformative nature of these demonstrations that this individual woman could experience is potentially so good that everyone agrees, including the participant, that it justifies the risk.
Look at it in a small way. So a year ago or something, we had an event for my work. So a lot of people came. It was like a big offsite for rapper collectors. And in this event, we had to form into groups and then do a presentation. And someone from the group was selected to do the presentation. Now, you know me.
Were they naked?
No, in my mind, maybe, but
were there
no.
orgasms involved?
No.
In my mind, maybe?
In my mind, maybe? Now, you know me. You can imagine that for my group, I would be the first to volunteer and probably be selected to be the one to speak for the group.
Yeah.
Which I was.
Yeah.
But unbeknownst to the group and the event organizers, I was at the time still not very leveled in terms of my thyroid replacement medicine. And guess what? That causes wild swings in hormones and anxiety. So I didn't know it when I said, yeah, I'll do it. But when I went to go up to give our presentation, which was nothing, it wasn't a high stakes presentation, but just the fact that I was in front of like 150 people or so, I, as I was speaking, had a panic attack, an anxiety attack. And it was, and then it took me, when I was done speaking, I went out of the room and went into a room to do breathing and calm myself down. My blood pressure rose, all these things. Did they do harm to me? Well, yes, but come on, it was not by intention. It was something that it, you know, they had no way of knowing. I was, so you can be harmed in a lot of ways by group things and by stuff that takes you out of your comfort zone. But there's a vast gulf of difference between that and almost engineered harm.
Right. The coercion of women to have sex with people that they don't want to have sex with.
Even the philosophy, because the philosophy of, you know what, we need to bring back the primal male aggression.
Right. So there's so much to talk about, but just a little bit on that is that if you watch the documentary, you know what we're talking about. But yeah, there were quotes from her saying things like, what's this quote that I have from her up here? That she says, what, something about being raped. Oh, she says, we're going to sell a shirt that says, I got raped and all I got was a victim story.
Right. And then she even said the same. And we could do the same for victimizers.
Right.
I was a victimizer and all I got was a victimizer story or something.
Right. Basically, her saying that being raped is no big deal.
Yeah.
And you get a victim story, la-ti-da. You know, you're choosing to see it as being victimized. She did a lot of things along those lines. And that's, if it's one thing to deny people their truth and to gaslight people into thinking that they weren't actually harmed, or they absolutely were. It's another thing to engineer the harm.
Yeah.
Because she would take people that would come forward and they would be like, you know, I don't know if I'm doing very well with all this. You know,
yeah.
I'm trying to follow the program and I'm having sex with all these men. A lot of these men are paying money to you to come to these events, and I'm having sex with them in front of a bunch of people. And I feel like I'm getting in touch with my sexuality in some ways, but I don't know if I want to do this today. They might say, could I just do something else? And then apparently, allegedly, Nicole would say, you are going completely counter to your health right now.
Yeah.
And if you want to be in line with your health, and if you want to be a part of this program, you will have sex with those three men who are paying money to me.
Yeah.
Because that's what's right for you. I'm telling you what's right for you. I know what's right for you. That's what allegedly she was doing, which is essentially what sex traffickers will do to the sex traffic.
Right. And they had this thing, like, I forget what they called it, like controlled aggression or planned aggression or something.
Yeah.
Something like this.
And seemingly, allegedly, and you could absolutely see this happening, there are predators, people who want to rape, sexual sadists, criminals, find out about this sort of thing through the internet or rumors or something. And they're like, wait, so there's an organization where women, without wanting to, are forced to have sex with men who pay money. And if I abuse them verbally, physically, sexually, the charismatic leader will convince my victim that it's all in their head.
And I'm not arrested for prostitution, and I'm fine, and I'm praised.
Yeah, and I'm actually... So there's a whole other thing where men have to get in touch with their beast. So on one
That's
hand,
right.
This is a good thing, I guess, that for some, you know, they were talking about nice guy syndrome, where there are a lot of men who were raised in a more sensitive, more feminist culture, which is a good thing, but maybe overly paranoid about enacting their sexuality within consensual limits, of course, because they don't want to be mistaken for someone who is coming across as a creep. You know,
yeah.
I have friends who, for years, I would hear them talk that if they were at a party and there was a cute, you know, potential partner came up to them and started talking to them, even though the woman was giving every signal that she wanted you to ask for a phone number, they would never, ever, ever, ever in a million years ask for a phone number because they don't want to be seen as a creep.
Right.
And I'm just like, okay, great.
Too far.
But yeah. You're probably giving off signals that you don't like someone potentially.
Right.
And so,
but
so
can't we imagine reframing it instead of like, we got to bring out the inner beast, the inner, you know, aggression, the beast of the male that grabs the woman by the hair.
Yeah.
Like, instead of that, couldn't it be like, we want to bring out the confident part of you,
right?
The complete human,
yeah.
The, you know, all these things.
Another part of this cult organization that was bothering me is seemingly everything was genderized and heteronormative. That men need to let out their beast and essentially become either confident, balanced men or rapists, depending on how far you go with it. And women have to let go of the notion that they are sluts if they want to have sex. Or to take it further, they have to allow themselves to be raped, and you know.
Just
so
used.
There was a good version, probably for a lot of people, where they
they
got to that good, you know. But many men don't need to increase their aggressiveness.
Yeah.
You know what I mean. And many women are already okay with the fact that they're a sexual creature. It just, I don't know, but it seemed to be kind of blanketly, women are from Venus, men are from Earth. So yeah, does it cause unreasonable harm? Yeah, it seemingly did. There were lots of things about this that could have been done in a way that wasn't harmful, but it was systematically changed or emphasized or intensified such that it actually did harm people according to allegations. Okay, the final criterion is number 7, that there is hard evidence that the above criteria have been met. Is there what evidence that you could actually take to a court of law?
I think that there was that one gal that actually
didn't come forward, but could have. Her sister did.
Yeah, that seems like a trial waiting to happen.
Right, because you know? She was talking about how her experiences were. She was run through a lot of the things we've talked about, where she tried to get out and she was convinced to stay back in, manipulated that. The several men who were probably predators to begin with, she was forced to have sex with and forced to be allowed to have them physically and sexually assault her.
The accusations were horrific.
Yeah.
So if that went to trial,
Right. And that wasn't the only person.
Right.
And a lot of the workers, you know, not just members, but people who were employees were saying like, I saw stuff like that. That didn't happen to me, but I saw that being
absolutely
implemented on other people.
Even some of the ones that are still sounding supportive and maybe even still admire the person, they were also saying that they were forced to do, you know, that they were coerced to do things they didn't actually want to do. So it wasn't, now granted, they didn't interview everyone probably, but they certainly didn't interview her, but there was a lot there that you could think, you could form a case. By the way, you mentioned something a little bit earlier that there's probably predators out there that would find this. I don't know if you recently saw this clip of this really disturbed guy that went to the cops complaining that he was pursuing this female with a mixtape that she was refusing to listen and that he was chasing her. And he was telling the cops, but you know, I mean, you know how women are. They have rape fantasies. Like, he was trying to convince the cops that it's just totally normal.
Yeah, I think
okay, that's the kind of guy you could risk getting into a situation like this where he's like, oh, see, I knew it. And great, now I can just pay some money. And instead of like chasing people downtown, I could just come here and do it.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it seems like instead of there being guardrails against that sort of person, well, at least from what we saw, it's almost like, yeah, great. You can talk to us about that male aggression.
Yeah. Not only are you healthy, but you will help these repressed females become more healthy.
Yeah.
Because you will subject them to your inner beast and they will have to wrestle with that and accept it because that's, and again, going back to her childhood, yikes.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So someone writes an article about this group and then the cult or the group stopped having events. They just went to online, which kind of says something. Then the FBI picks up the story and they start investigating. It's still an ongoing investigation. Allegations are sex trafficking, as we said, illegal sex work, which isn't probably a huge violation. Sex trafficking is a huge violation. And also violating labor laws. That one guy said he was promised profit sharing on the order of like 40% or something.
And then it was like not really anything.
They kept walking it back. And yeah, you can't hire someone and tell someone you're going to give them a certain benefit or compensation and then just slowly not do that for them. So another bit of thing here, it says, former members have testified that One Taste resembled a kind of prostitution ring and sex trafficking. And then in 2015, a former employee received a quote-unquote six-figure settlement for sexual assault and harassment. So someone did win a settlement. They didn't actually, the trier of fact wasn't put to the test, but at the very least, the lawyers for One Taste decided, well, let's pay this person out so that we can move on. So who knows about that? And Nicole herself moved out of the country and became like an author, but I think now she's back in country. So anyway, all right. To close it out, Berto, how many Bertos out of 10 would you give it?
Well, the documentary, like I said, I've seen better documentaries in their format, so I'd probably give the format 6. In terms of entertainment, it's a weird word to use because it's horrific subject matter as well. But it was very interesting, so I'd give it an 8 in that sense.
Yeah. Probably give it, like a 6 or 7, maybe a 6. Critics on Rotten Tomatoes. What do you think they...
Oh, interesting. I didn't think... I knew you were going to ask me, but... I'd say 80%.
Smack dab on it there, Berto.
Really?
80.
Wow.
Yeah. You got the finger right in there. lots of people saying about how enthralling and engaging it was.
Yeah.
Audience.
Oh, man. It's a topic, a hot topic, so I'll go 87%.
33.
So my experience actually is not uncommon. I was actually too generous, it seems.
Well, let me read you some of the bad reviews.
Okay.
Just another canceled culture film.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
Why didn't I think of this? Of course.
Well, what do you mean, of course?
Of course I should know that the people complaining are like, everyone's too sensitive. Why would they cancel her? They did it voluntarily. Women are just, they want it both ways. And they really want the bad guy, but then they complain when they get raped. Oh my gosh.
Yeah. Another bad review that was representative is, the beauty of the real story isn't even close to the one being told.
That sounds more like what I would probably have said, unless I misunderstood. Like, it sounds like there's a lot more to the story that the documentary...
Well, I don't know. But the way I interpreted it was that a lot of people are members or were members or liked... Because I don't think this is a very popular...
Oh, I see. Like the beauty of this club is actually not being well represented.
Right.
I see. Okay, fine.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I have no idea. You know...
And it's... I mean, look, it's possible. We just saw a perspective, right? We were shown a perspective.
Well, the thing is... Yeah, could 99% of the participants and even the employees of One Taste have experienced neutral to positive experiences?
Yeah.
Sure, but is it to have that 1% even?
Well, wait, what am I talking about? It's not like they don't have her on film saying the things that I find abhorrent.
Right.
So just start from that.
Yeah, I mean, several things that she said about rape being all in your mind.
Yeah.
And, yeah, it's pretty awful. But I wonder if a lot of the... You know, it's sort of like when certain nerd movies come out, like a Star Wars movie comes out, and they will review bomb the review section. I wonder if One Taste members review bombed, because it's not a 33. I wouldn't give it an 80 the way that Rotten Tomatoes critics. Yeah, like a 6, but a 33? Like,
yeah, 33 is very low.
It's an interesting 90-minute documentary, right?
Imagine if I said, hey, murderers, like, they get a bad rap, right? And first of all, you can't be murdered if you want to die in the moment.
Right.
And that's essentially what she was saying. She was
being
saying,
being murdered is just a matter of perspective.
That's right. You can't be raped if you fully give in to the ohm.
Hey, everyone dies, and you're just going to get reincarnated anyway.
So this is why I'm like, yeah, whatever. What I saw on tape that she's proud to have out there in the world is her position on rape. So
she knows she's being videotaped in those moments. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yes. But if she, as a victim herself, you can't blame her for having a skewed point of view.
I feel like, as I said, even when I was watching Dahmer, all these things, I just feel this tremendous pain for the suffering of little children all throughout history, all the time. And then they, sadly, in a lot of cases, end up being adults that harm others, right? It's horrible. There's no good side to that story. But it doesn't mean that we have to excuse or participate or support the abuse and the behavior.
Mm-hmm. Well, that does it for that episode of Psychology in Seattle. Everyone out there, please take care of yourself. Question your charismatic gurus because
you deserve it.